Hey, listeners. Is 2023 going to be the year you finally click through and start exploring the idea of becoming a book coach? If you've been intrigued by all the conversations we've had about book coaching over the years here at #MWriting, maybe this is your year to make it happen. Author Accelerator's Book Coach Certification Program teaches you the key editorial, project management, client intaking, and emotional skills necessary to launch your own book coaching business. I've done their program, and even after years as an editor for the New York Times, I expanded my skills dramatically, and my approach to helping others with their books and to writing my own is so much better. The best part? No publishing experience is necessary to be good at this work. Are you curious to see if you have what it takes? Head to bookcoaches.com/podcasts now to take Author Accelerator's free quiz to find out if you have the skills and characteristics needed to launch your own book coaching business today.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay.
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. Try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause.
I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3. Okay.
Hey, I'm KJ Delatonia, and this is #MWriting. Weekly podcast about writing all the things, short things, long things, pitches, proposals, fiction, nonfiction. This is the podcast about finding a way to sit down and get your work done.
I'm Jess Leahy. I am the author of The Gift of Failure and The Addiction Inoculation. And you can find my work at The New York Times and The Washington Post and The Atlantic and lots of other places.
And I am KJ Delatonia, the author of the novel The Chicken Sisters and the other novel In Her Boots, and the third novel that's coming out sometime this year, Playing the Witch Card. I didn't really let that roll off my tongue right. I'm also the author of the nonfiction book, How to Be a Happier Parent, and the former editor and lead writer of The Motherload at The New York Times.
And you may actually hear some snoring in the background because I'm the only person home today, and there is a dog in my lap sleeping. So if the snores come in, apologies. Those are my dogs, not mine. I'm not sleeping on the job. We have a guest today, and I'm super duper excited, mainly because we've known this person for a very long time. She still is, kind of one of the OG, I know we all hate this term, she was one of the OG mommy bloggers, and we met her through sort of a long time ago through those channels, but she is now, Kristen May Chase, is one of the big time parenting podcast people out there. She's just done some really, really cool things. And one of them is that her first blog was called Motherhood Uncensored, which evolved. You've had a really cool evolution. Lots of different things have happened here, Kristen, but it has eventually turned into Spawned, a podcast that she does with Liz Gumminer. And she runs Cool Mom Picks, including Cool Mom Eats and Cool Mom Tech. It's sort of like just the best curation of cool mom things. I love all of it. And the reason we have her on today is that she has made a really interesting genre shift from writing. She has written nonfiction in the past, and she has been a journalist, and she's done all of this work talking about parenting, and she has a novel coming out. And so, not unlike our beloved KJ's story, we wanted to talk a little bit about genre hopping. We wanted to talk a little bit about stories and how they reflect our own experiences. And she has a wonderful book coming out called 1,000 Miles to Graceland. This mother-daughter road trip has them all shook up. Welcome to the show, Kristen May Chase.
Oh, I am so happy to be here with both of you. This is exciting.
I can't even remember where we originally met, but it was probably one of the mommy blog conference things. And I'm just so happy. First of all, congratulations, because the book is wonderful and we're really excited to talk about it. But as our listeners know, we don't just have people to come on and talk about their books. We have them come on to talk about the hurdles, the problems, the questions they answered, the things they solved while they were writing. And you did some really, really cool things with this book in terms of your own story and in terms of what you were looking for in writing this book. So first of all, I just want to say that when I started to read this book and I knew the story of this book, and we're going to get into that in just a minute, so many people say, I can't write X book until the people involved are gone, or until I have the opportunity to sort of write it in a vacuum and have analyzed it from every perspective. But one of the things you talk about in an interview you did about the book was, quote, you can create resolutions and endings that you never got in your actual life. And I would love for you to talk about this book in terms of that point, that answer you gave in that interview.
Yes, absolutely. You know, what's interesting is that it is a novel, so it's not a memoir. But, you know, my main character, Grace Johnson, is a 40-something mixed-race Asian-American woman, which sounds very familiar. And her mother, Laura Lynn, is a 70-something, well, turning 70 in the book. It's her birthday. Chinese-American woman who is obsessed with Elvis. And while my mom is not obsessed with Elvis, there are similarities. And certainly many of the things that happen in the book, the bright spots and some of the low spots, did actually happen in one way or another. And it was so therapeutic for me. And I'll be honest, when I started this 10 years ago, it was not about that at all. It really was never about trying to work out the challenges of the relationship that I have currently and in the past with my mother. It was, I had this fun character who's obsessed with Elvis, like how cool and quirky and fun she would be to write. But as I started writing and it evolved and did the 400 million edits, which is what it feels like, when it's almost not, that's actually not completely inaccurate. But I realized that there was so much more here. And it was really about the process of healing the relationship with my mom and myself. So yeah, it is something I did. I didn't tell my mom I was doing this. In fact, my mom just read the book 2 weeks ago and we spoke about it last night. So there's a lot to talk about there. But yeah, I wrote this and my pain and the challenges I have with my mom are still ongoing.
There's so much that's scary about being a writer. I mean, creating things, words, you know, these, we joke, there are all sorts of jokes about, you know, birthing a book because it's like putting a child out in the world. But then there's this whole other level you're talking about of fear with family responses. I mean, even when I wrote my The Addiction Inoculation and, you know, no one reads my work until, except for my editor and my agent, until it's actually in galley form. And so my husband and my family were reading a lot of things for the first time. And that's really, really scary. But because this book is so central to a relationship with one person, how did you manage the fear of the response with the actual writing process, which needs to be free from that in some sense in order to have it be as deep as and as honest as possible?
I think for me, it was that it was fiction. So maybe that was, in a way, an excuse or a crutch, right? Because I could always say, well, it's Grace and Laura Lynn. It's not actually Kristen and Audrey, which is my mom's name. And from a psychological perspective, that's actually really powerful, right? To be able to work out something, but also present this story, which, you know, is fun and full of laughter, but also has some difficult parts, which is, I think, the nature of all human relationships, really. But to be able to present that and have, I don't want to call it a wall, but a sort of protection, right? To say, actually, this isn't really me and you, Mom. This is actually Grace and Laura Lynn. And I think that, to be honest with you, in doing that, allowed my mom and I to be able to talk about some of the things that were present in the book that also happened to be present in our relationship in a safe way. So I think in some ways, writing fiction and telling my own story through it has been safer, right? Because while I am attached to it, there is a level of separation that the character is Grace. Her outcome and her experience is in many ways different than mine. And the same goes for Laura Lynn, my other character.
The book is so touching and it's so you do such a great job of creating these people who are so different and yet butt heads in really interesting ways. I'm wondering, so you said that you came up with sort of this character and how fun would this character be. Did the character come first or did the idea of this sort of reconciliation trip come first?
That is a great question. And I'll be honest, I've been writing this book for so long, I don't even remember. I mean, it's been about 10 years. I was looking back, you know, thank goodness for Google Docs, right? Because you can go back and look at the date that the document was started. And I think, honestly, it was like 2012. And I even think that that was an iteration after I originally started. But I will say in my memory, my closest memory, it was this idea of a senior woman, right, a 70-year-old woman who was obsessed with Elvis and wore crazy wigs and dressed what some may describe, although I don't do that, but some may describe as dressing too young for her age and short skirts and platform shoes and just quite a character, right, in all forms of that word. And then it really was, I think, closely followed by this idea of how that affected her daughter and how that relationship was so fraught. And then how going to Graceland, this idea of taking this trip and really being able to work out their relationship on the drive came very closely thereafter. But I have to say, every other part of the book has changed. Every other part. Honestly, I will even say this, I'll be very honest. I wrote these characters as white at the beginning. And as a mixed race Chinese American woman who grew up as white, right? Like I was white passing. My mom's Chineseness, if you will, was something that was more of a novelty. So it was like, oh, it's cool. And she makes shrimp with lobster sauce, but we weren't really close to our family. She was estranged from her own mother. So it really wasn't a part of my existence. And, you know, nothing felt really right about it. And right before I ended up doing a huge edit, which I know we'll talk about, I was like, you know what? There was something that I just wasn't able to connect with these characters. And when I shifted them to be what my own existence is, right? What my mom was born in this country. She's a second generation Chinese American and I am biracial. It changed everything for the story.
That is so cool. That actually was something that from the very first couple of pages, we were texting about this book just over the weekend. And that was one of the things that we loved the most in the first. Serena actually commented on it. You have a quote about eyeliner in the first like two pages and immediately sets the stage for this being for, you know, where these characters are coming from in terms of even just their facial features being a major part of the story. So you did a really beautiful job of that. I really, really liked it. And one of the things that also struck me is I wanted to talk about how you stay on the right side of the line when you're writing about something that's really personal and something that maybe you're struggling with in your own life, how you keep it on the correct side of the line so that you're not subjecting your readers to your own therapy. We've talked about this in a couple of podcasts where this came from a long time ago. I had read a book and I mentioned to KJ, I just wish this author had gotten therapy before she wrote the book and therefore imposed her therapy on her readers. So that's something I'm always really curious about because, you know, all of us have stories that we would love to write about. And how do we stay on the right side of that line?
It's really hard, honestly. It's really difficult to do. And it's especially difficult when you're writing the scenes that are inspired by real life events, because I think that's very limiting. Mm-hmm. I had a much easier time writing the stories that I came up like completely out of nowhere. And I'll be honest, I too don't let anyone read my work. I think maybe I was trying to impress my boyfriend early on in our relationship. And I did actually let him read it, which is crazy now that I think about it. I was like, what was I doing? I was like, I wrote a book, you know, and he read it. And his favorite scenes, actually, it turned out, and he didn't know, he was just telling me, he's a filmmaker, and the ones that really evoked the most from him were the scenes that were from my imagination. completely, actually. And so that was something that I thought about in my edits, was really trying to be free and not being held to the rules. And I'm a rule follower, right? Like I like an outline. I am someone who's like, this is the story and this is how we tell it, or, you know, this is the way you do this. So it really challenged me as a writer to say, just because this actually happened, doesn't mean it has to be like that in the book. So what is the essence of that experience that you're trying to get across? And then express that to your readers, as opposed to making it a direct retelling. So I had to remind myself a lot during the process, for sure. And quite honestly, there was a point when I was editing this that I knew that I had to work some stuff out. And I actually talked to my mom, and we had like an over 2-hour conversation, and a lot of the pain and the difficulties that I had experienced that were coming out in the book ended up sort of being answered and resolved. So I was kind of in a therapeutic way working things out through writing, but then took an opportunity to get that settled before I moved on to the next step.
I think that part of the challenge of writing fiction when you're typically a nonfiction writer, which definitely describes you, most of your previous work has been, you know, reported slash, audio, but it's all, you know, it's all nonfiction, and getting past that, but it really happened this way, or, but that seems so unlikely, or, but I can't do it that way because that's not what really happened, or that's not what would happen. I think that's really hard for people who've written in nonfiction. And I'm thinking, so I am an adoptive parent, and I just finished The Storied Life of A.J. Fickrey, which a lot of people have read. And it's a book with a lot of drama to it. And there's an adoption that takes place with it that it was just not, I mean, just no, like that's just not. And the watching other writers let that stuff happen really helps me. Were there things in the book where you were like, I can't do it that way because that might not be real, and then you finally just had to let that go?
So many things, really, you know, and it was sort of a differing experience. So like one was like, you know, there is a scene where in the book where they're at a pool party and the father is an alcoholic and gets super drunk and has to be taken away by the police. And that actually in some ways happened in my life. And but it was different, right? So it was like, for me, I had the real things that happened, but I also had the small changes, even in the scenery, right? Like even just changing, like, oh, was at a party? Oh, there was a pool party, or she was hiding. And, you know, just as a way to sort of push me to make it different and not make it real. But then, you know, there are things on the flip side. There's a scene very early on in the book where they stop at a diner and there is an Elvis show, which is something completely imaginary that I made up. And it sounds, I suppose people would be like, really? Is there really an Elvis show at the back of a diner? You know, like, I don't know. It's Texas. You know what I'm saying? I love Texas, but it's like anything's possible. But the truth is, there's a diner near me. And that scene was inspired by a sign that I kept driving by. And I'll be honest, I kind of kicked myself that I didn't stop and see the darn Elvis show. But it literally said, Elvis show in the back, inquire inside. And I am like, why did I not go? But then the other part of me is like, I'm kind of glad I didn't go, because that's one of my favorite scenes in the book. And I completely just made it up out of the blue based on that sign that I kept seeing every day driving by.
Yeah, we've talked about my drive to like research the heck out of everything. And so in this novel that I'm writing right now, there have been so many moments where I'm like, I can't do it that way because that's not how it works in real life. and Serena will text and say, let go. If it's your story and it's your thing, you can have it do what you want it to do. And it's been really hard for me to get over that hurdle. But the more I'm able to do it, the more interesting my work gets because it's of my own imagining. And I love the fact that that there's this part of us that feels so restricted by facts, but that in fiction, you can just let that go. And it's really hard to do. But
it's so hard. Well, I'm thinking about you, Jess, especially, not that KJ isn't like a super researcher, but your books are so research-based, like really heavily research-based. So I imagine it's very challenging. And, you know, what was even harder for me, but also delightful, is that I did the trip. So before I started on edits of this book with my agent, which, by the way, I edited this for an entire year before it went on submission. So it was with my agent for a year we were editing. And I was like, you know, I really need to do this drive. I really should. It's an actual drive. It's 1,000 miles-ish. And it goes from El Paso through Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, and then Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And I did it in June of 2020. And on one hand, it was fabulous. I got like the smell of oil in Odessa, Texas that I would never have known about that I think really adds to that scene. But then there were, you know, parts of it where there is an actual cemetery, you know, there's the actual Elvis monuments that I go through, and it was tricky. There were even actual people who exist in real life. Mm-hmm. And I got like, oh, I got to name them that. It turned out that these people had really great names. So that would have made it a little easier. But it was challenging for me to sort of just have the vibe and sit with it and be like, what would it be like? I mean, I rented a convertible and everything. But also try to determine what facts were important. Obviously, the name of the drive-through, where, you know, he ate, important. The way that the server at the restaurant spoke to us, I could play around with that. I could have a little fun.
Yeah. I love, there was one book I was going to write. I may still write it, but there's a particular cemetery where this one particular scene takes place. And it was really great for me to go and sit in that particular cemetery and get not necessarily the actual gravestones and all that stuff, but the vibe. And there was actually a New York trip that I did with Serena, and she needed her hockey team in the series she does set in Brooklyn. Her hockey team practices in Dumbo, and there's a particular apartment building where a lot of the players live, and it's an actual building. And so she's got in her head these actual locations. And for me, anyway, that makes it more fun to read her books. But it's also interesting to me, just as a side note, how we were talking about this, I think, yesterday, because Serena got a comment on a book, on a fiction book, about how her details weren't right for this very specific place that she had never been. And there are always going to be those people that are going to pick you apart in that way. But on the other hand, there's this incredible freedom. Often when I've been at the end of my nonfiction books, I have this fantasy land where I'm like, wouldn't it be great if this were just fiction and I didn't have to like look up every single source that I used for this entire thing? But it's also really hard. So anyway, I really appreciate that journey. Can you tell us a little bit, like, so I tend to hang out with these KJ and Serena, and they finish books in like lightning speed, especially Serena. So talk to us what it looks like when you have a book that's been sitting in the hopper for 10 years. And the reason I ask about that is that there's so many people who have had a book sitting in the hopper for 10 years that never gets finished. It becomes like this thing that becomes bigger than the book itself because it's been going on for so long. How did you actually bring that to completion?
Well, it took a really long time, clearly, and it took a lot of, you know, different people, honestly, who were really encouraging and were also very honest with feedback, some of which I really wasn't ready to accept. And that's also why it took so long, is because I had to put it aside. Mm-hmm. So I started writing it about 10 years ago, let's just say. And I was writing scenes. I had no idea what I was doing at all, really. Truly, I'm not just saying it's imposter syndrome. It actually was. I didn't know what I was doing. I was just writing and writing. And as someone who also has a background in research as a professor, and I wrote textbooks, I just wanted someone to tell me how to do this. And so I read all the books and I would ask my friends, like, do I need an outline? I think I need an outline. Maybe I need, do I need to write a plot? So like, I and I spent so much time in some ways on like trying to figure out the how of doing it. And then at some point, I don't know what it was. It may have been a friend of mine who said, you just got to sit down and write. You just got to do it. Just do it. Just
darn
1,500
it. That's
words
the most
a day.
Frustrating suggestion ever. Why can't
it
I just
is.
Research how to do it for 10 years and then it'll magically appear at the end of that?
Exactly. And, you know, I have friends like both of you. You know, I'm friendly with like Jenny Lawson. I'm friendly with like Delilah Dawson. Like these are people who are New York Times bestselling authors. I'm like, come on, people. Like, help a girl out here. Can you please tell me what I'm supposed to be doing? And, you know, I took classes. I took a finish the novel. There was a point where I was like, okay, either this is going to be set aside and this was a pipe dream. I just need to leave it alone or I need to do it. And that's the kind of person that I am, really. I am like, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. So I took a class at Gotham Writers Workshop. I did a finish your draft and it was great. I did it. And then I took a critique class and I finished that. And then I was like, this is the best thing ever. Oh my gosh, I did it. It's so awesome. It's too short, right? But whatever. And I was like, I'm gonna invest in this. And I got a developmental editor, right? So this was like in succession. So I would say like maybe like 3 or 4 years in, I made the decision. I got the developmental editor. And it was the best money I ever spent. And she, you know, had worked as an editor at a publishing house. She was really all about like, what is selling? How does this become marketable for you? Right. And basically she came back and she was like, you're a great writer, but there's no story at all. And I was like, screw you. I mean, honestly, that's how I felt. I was angry. I was like, I'm a good writer. What are you talking about? She's like, there's a ton of plot. It's super fun. I think this can be something, but you have no story here at all. And I was like, okay, whatever you like, whatever, lady. I put it aside.
You clearly need a different editor. That's the answer to that question.
I know. I was like, you don't know what you're talking about. And you know,
What did she tell you about the distinction she was making? I mean, I get that distinction between plot and story, but I'm interested in how she tried to convey that to you.
You know, it was really the word story arc didn't really make it. And again, this is I haven't looked at her notes in a long time, but I didn't gather that. And quite honestly, if I had heard that, I think it would have been easier for me to swallow. It was more of like, I don't understand your character's motivation, right? Like, I don't understand why she's doing this. I don't think. And originally it was that she decided, Grace decided that she wanted to make things right with her mom, and that's why she did the trip. She's like, I don't really believe that enough. Mm-hmm. It needs to be desperation because she doesn't get along with her mom.
It's a why now question.
Why now? Yeah. And so it was that. I don't get her motivation, right? I don't see her changing at the end. And she also just felt like she was sarcastic. You know, Grace is, right? She's a little sarcastic. She's funny. But she didn't change. She was the same. And that was what spoke to me later on. So it was really those things. And really what helped me is that the developmental editor gave me a lot of suggestions like, okay, maybe her marriage falls apart. Maybe her this happens. Maybe this. Like, and that had never been anything. You never do that really in nonfiction, right? Like, that's just not something I ever did. But like, in a story, you could have 17 different ways the story could go. Like, pick your poison or pick whichever one seems the best. And that really helped me process like, oh, she could do this. She could do this. She could do this. What do I like? What makes sense? What resonates with me? And so that was what helped me. Like, she really gave me suggestions as to like what it could be. And then quite honestly, the story arc for Grace, I don't know if other writers have this. I have the disease of like the best friend or the other character where like my other characters are always cooler. Like Grace was like kind of a dud and Laura Lynn was like so awesome and cool. It's like the sort of, I call it like the best friend disease, right? Where like, you know, like they're the funniest and they have so many characteristics and your main character is sort of just like, like that was kind of my issue. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really get that until I worked with my agent. And was like, okay, what is it? It's about her becoming more vulnerable, right? And that, how does that look? And that changed everything, right? It changed the scene when she did karaoke, right? Like all of the things that really informed everything. But that didn't come until a really long time, I have to say. It took a while.
Well, and once you're so invested in those characters and you maybe you like them, we, KJ and Serena talk about this a lot, is how hard it is to throw stones at your people. These are, you know, they've become people to you and you've got to put them in peril. You've got to put them in situations in which they are forced to make decisions. And that can be oddly painful, oddly emotional to do that.
Oh, for sure.
I think it's letting them make the dumb choice.
Yeah.
That is hard for me personally. I'm always like, but you know, she's an emotionally mature adult human being. She wouldn't, you know, do this to her sister or whatever. And you can't do that, right? You have to let them have their flaw, even though you know how they're going to hopefully improve.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. And I think for me in particular, because I'm mixed race and because my character is mixed race, and in particular, really, you see how race plays out with Laura Lynn. It changed everything, especially for Laura Lynn when she was made Asian, right? Like when I made her Chinese like my own mom. It changed everything because how her Elvis obsession, right? Like how that was used to protect her and all of those intricacies of being Asian in America and being biracial in America also really helped bring that story arc to life for me. So, you know, I know that for me, and I think I just also felt more connected to the story and to the characters when I was able to do that.
Can I tell you, I have to tell you what my very favorite line in the entire book is, mainly because it gets at this point. You know, they're traveling to Graceland, this place that's been, you know, this monolith, this mythical, you know, and there's a line where, and I can't remember who says it, is, what if it's just a house? And that, to me, spoke to so many aspects of this, whether it's a relationship and, you know, especially mother-daughter relationships, you know, you have these ideas of how they're supposed to be. And what if the relationship we have is just what it is? What if it's just a house? And, you know, you have these ideas of these things that are going to be huge in your life. And sometimes we have to look at them and say, you know, what if this is just what it is? It's this simple thing. And I just thought that was a beautiful, beautiful line. I circled it and put little stars next to it. I really loved it.
Well, you know, what's funny is that when I went to see Graceland the first time, I kind of was like, it's kind of just a house. <You know? laughs> I had that moment. It's separate from what it means in the book. But I found it fascinating that, like, you know, and I don't know. Have you been to Graceland?
No.
We kind of need to talk about that. Okay, neither of you have been to Graceland. So I taught college in Mississippi. And so on the way to Mississippi, I stopped in Memphis. And the first time I saw Graceland, like, you just kind of, like, park and walk across the street and it's like a white, big white house with columns. I mean, it's not like you would see now, like you think of like where Beyonce lives or whatever, right? Like it does not look like that at all. Now, more recently, they've changed it and it has, I don't want to say a Disney World vibe, but there's like an entranceway that's across the street and there's like, you know, where you buy tickets and there's restaurants and, you know, souvenir stores. And then you actually take a bus over to Graceland now. So that has actually changed. So the grandeur feels a little bigger, but there is a feeling of like, oh, it's just a house, right? Like it's not what I think, you know, people who haven't seen photos of it, you know, it's like Elvis Presley. I mean, now, like, inside, it is, like, swanky in a 70s, 80s sort of way. But, you know, that line so much for me has to do with, you know, yes, like, sometimes that's what it is. You know, it's just a house and that's okay. But also that, like, it wasn't necessarily about Graceland, right? It was about getting there. And that's such a great way to think about life and relationships and projects. I mean, I think about how much that informs what I do now, that it's not necessarily about the end, but like everything that led up to it and led up to getting there.
And that's, you know, a developmental editor or an agent or your editor at a publisher is going to say, okay, well, what's going to make people identify with this? And there's so many, you know, your book is very specific to us, to this trip and to these people and to, you know, the Elvis stuff. And yet it's a wonderfully universal story. So I really loved it. I thought it was just a total delight. And as someone who, you know, is on an ongoing journey with my mom, too, there was so much that I could identify with as well. I think we need to take a quick break, KJ, so that we can talk about what we've been reading.
We love it when our guest goes first, Kristen, so you're on the hot seat. What is something you have read and loved lately? Or liked?
Oh, well, I loved this, so it's an easy book to gush about. And in fact, I am very fortunate that the author, Celeste Ng, actually tweeted me back after I gushed on it on Twitter, which is always lovely to do. So it's the book Everything I Never Told You. And it's by Celeste Ng. The last name is spelled N-G. And, you know, she, I think, is most known for probably Little Fires Everywhere is something that people are most familiar with. And what resonated most with me about this book is that it features a mixed race family. And so the mother is white. The father is Chinese. And so the children, who actually are in some ways the oldest, is a focus in this book, is like me, right, as a teenager. And I have to say, other than my own book, I have never read a book. I am 46 years old, just putting that out there. I have never read a book where the one parent is Chinese in my family. My mom is Chinese. My dad is German. But either way, I've never read a story where I resonated so much with the family and with the children and with the struggles. And it really got me thinking, actually, because similar, I think, in some ways to A Thousand Miles, my book, right? There are those, I guess, moments where race and ethnicity come into play, and they're interwoven in the story, right? It is not necessarily what I would say the central part of the story itself, but it is there. It is present, and it is addressed in various ways. And I think Celeste does that as well with this book. And I don't know. I couldn't put it down. It's not necessarily something that the genre itself is that I'm drawn to. But boy, it had me thinking, and I couldn't recommend it more. I mean, it is fantastic.
Over and over again, you know, we talk about when it comes to literacy and children's literature in particular, we talk so much about representation that it really matters with kids, because if you can't see yourself in books, then, you know, where are you going to be able to see yourself? It's such an important part. And that's really cool. Love it. KJ, what have you been reading?
I just finished Black Cake by Charmaine Wilkerson. Hope I'm getting that. Please double check that author name. But it is amazing. It is astonishing. It was a read with Jenna Pick. It is now out in paperback. I had it sitting around in hardback. I think I book of the month did. I don't know. Anyway, it's a massive family story. You wouldn't think this would work, because the trope is mother leaves audio story of her life and her secrets for son and daughter. And boy, are they juicy. And boy, are there a lot of secrets. But it's amazing. It's this, it's all central to this Caribbean cake called Black Cake. And it's also all central to the Black experience in the UK and in America. It's very diaspora based, so it's a different approach to that, or it's a different version of that experience, which I love. But mostly it's also just this massive multi-point of view family story that hops around in time while you're trying to figure out, well, who are these people really and what really happened? And so gross, so engrossing, so amazing. So I highly recommend that one.
Well, I'm really sorry to report. I'm in at one of those, and this hardly ever happens to me, but I have read and been frustrated with pretty much everything I've read. And as we tend to do on this podcast, if it's, we don't love it, we don't tend to talk about it. So they will go unnamed. But I've been reading a lot of thrillers because that's what I'm writing. And now the problem is that when there's this problem with thrillers where, like, you can get so engrossed in the first bit, and if they can't stick the landing, I just get angry. And now I'm all freaked out about my own ability to stick the landing, because I've read in the past couple of weeks maybe 8 thrillers, and one of them sort of stuck the landing. And so now I'm in this mental death spiral about my own ending. But, you know, I have just started Reese Witherspoon's new pick, In the House in the Pines, and haven't gotten very far. I'm only in like the first 2 chapters. So I'm hoping this one will deliver. We'll see what happens, but the reviews have been great. And we'll see. I'm doing this one on audio, and I'm just hoping, just keeping my fingers crossed. Stick the landing. Yeah. So anyway. Thank you so much. And one thing we didn't get a chance to talk about is that you also have a picture book coming out in 2023. And so maybe we can have you back to talk about the picture book, because that one sounds really, really interesting too. And that's coming out from FSG in 2023. When in 2023?
I don't actually know. Okay. It's supposed to be fall. So hopefully it'll definitely be before the end of this year.
And it's called We Are American. And I'm really excited to get my hands on that as well. So maybe we'll have you back to talk about picture book life and picture book author life. So thank you so, so much. And again, Kristen's book is 1,000 Miles to Graceland. And can you tell the listeners where they can find you if they would like to find all things Kristen May Chase?
Oh, I love hearing from folks. Absolutely. So I am That Kristen Again, and it's Kristen with an E-N, That Kristen Again on Instagram. That's because I was originally on Instagram as That Kristen and then got mad at Instagram, as I think many of us do, and closed my account. So I lost that handle. So that's why it's That Kristen Again, because I'm also really creative making social handles. And I'm just That Kristen on Twitter. And my website is KristenMayChase.com. And I am so thrilled to be able to talk to both of you about the book. It's been so long writing it, but I haven't actually had an opportunity to kind of industry, like, talk about it with other writers. And so I'm really grateful to be able to chat with you about it. It's been awesome.
I know that there are listeners in our audience that have a book that's been sitting there, you know, at those 10-year things, and they begin to feel so big that you couldn't possibly finish it. So I love that we got to address the kick in the pants required to actually get the 10-year novel to the finish line. And congratulations, because that's a big hairy deal. It really is. You should feel very, very proud of yourself. All right, everyone, until next week, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game.
The Hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output, because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Listeners, if you're not following along with Jess on Instagram and TikTok, you should be, because she's killing it with advice on kids and addiction, and because she's learning things about Reels and TikTok that could apply to you too, and she'll be sharing more soon, so you're going to want to know what's been going on. Look for her on Instagram as @teacherleahy and on TikTok as @jessleahy.